Thank you, Mr. Rosenwald.
All right. Why don't we go ahead and reconvene and go back on the record? That was the word I was looking for 15 minutes ago. Mr. Easley, I would remind you that you are still under oath.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Hickey, your witness.
Thank you, Mr. Burbidge. Mr. Easley, we're in agreement, aren't we, that the costs of running a minor league baseball franchise are not recoverable under Section 26 of this commission's rules as a wholesale power commodity cost, correct?
I think so. You're correct, yes.
Could you look at page 6, line 6 of your testimony for me? And that would be in the Supreme Court Exhibit Notebook. And I believe it's, counsel can give you the exact exhibit number. And my reference is page 6. Just let me know when you're there, please.
Mr. Hickey, I'm on page 6.
Okay. Isn't it true that you stated, Mr. Easley, that Precor has not objected to Dakota Gasification Company's inclusion in rates paid by Precor to Basin? You said that on line 6, didn't you?
I am not tracking. I'm on page 6 of my testimony.
Yeah, the question is, why hasn't Precorp objected to DGC impacting Basin's bottom line?
Right.
And you have stated that you have not objected and you discussed benefits. Can we agree?
Yes.
Okay, and you say at line 6 of your testimony that, quote, we understand there is still a net benefit to Precorp, that being from Dakota Gasification. It just isn't as obvious, close quote. You said that, didn't you?
Yes.
So you mean that in 2016, you think there's still benefits, but they're just not as obvious as they have been in the past? Correct?
Yes.
And it's true, isn't it, Mr. Easley, that Precorp has not performed an audit on the cost associated with the Dakota Gasification Company that Basin seeks to recover from Precorp in this docket? Agreed?
I would agree with that.
We can also agree that there has not been an independent study or analysis of the costs associated with Dakota Gasification Company for which recovery is sought in this COPA proceeding. Isn't that also true?
I'll object to the extent it asks if Basin has done anything, but to the extent that it asks what Mr. Easley knows, obviously. We have no objection.
Please proceed. Please answer. Objection is
you need the question again, Mr. Easley?
That would be helpful, Mr. Hickey. I'm sorry to be
It's true, isn't it, that Precorp has not done an independent study or analysis of the costs associated with Dakota Gasification for which recovery is sought in this talk?
I would agree.
In fact, Mr. Easley, you state that you rely on Ms. Sorensen's testimony to support your statement that a net benefit continues to Precorp from the operations of Dakota Gas Corporation, don't you? And you do that on that same page 6 at lines 9 through 10, correct?
Yes, I do, yep.
Would you agree, Mr. Easley, that an independent study of the contributions, if any, of Dakota Gasification to Precorp should be done?
I believe we trust Basin Electric and their work on this. We wouldn't see a reason to commission an independent study or audit in order to do that.
I'm going to direct you, Mr. Easley, to another exhibit in the joint intervener notebook, and you'll find it at 234.2. And just to help you know that we're on the same page, I'm asking you to find the Basin Electric press release wherein Basin Electric announces Class A rate increase is the headline of the press release. Just let me know when you find that.
I found that.
Okay, you were aware that Basin identified five drivers or reasons affecting its purported need to increase wholesale power rates to Class A customers by virtue of this press release. Isn't that true?
That's true.
And in fact, those drivers are the bullet points identified in the middle of what's marked as 234.2 at page one of that release, correct?
Correct.
And the offered reasons in the order that they were identified were: one, lower than anticipated member sales, correct?
That's correct.
Two, reduced revenue from non-member sales, agreed?
With the parenthetical surplus sales, yes.
Sure. The third driver being added cost to operate generation facilities, correct?
Correct.
The fourth, generation and transmission investments, agreed?
Yes.
And then fifth and final identified point is, and reduced revenue support from non-electric or subsidiary businesses, parent Dakota Gasification Company. That was the fifth reason offered, or the fifth driver for the increase, correct?
That's correct.
And it's true, isn't it, Mr. Easley, that Precorp didn't undertake any analysis of any of the five offered drivers for the increase in rates that are for which recovery is being sought in this docket. Agreed?
Agreed, and I would note that we were probably cause for two of them.
I could have just a minute, Mr. Burke. No further questions of Mr. Easley.
Thank you, Mr. Hickey. Ms. Fish, do you have questions of this witness?
I do.
Please proceed.
Good morning. So I'm going to be changing topics a little bit. My first questions are going to focus on the billing process of Precorp. Commission staff investigations have shown that Precorp has been implementing rates up to a month prior to its usage on and after effective date. Are you aware of this?
Oh, yes, I am.
Will you please explain how to reverse billing process?
I can certainly make a run at it, but I can't go too. I could only get a few layers into the onion. I think Joanne has got is very much detailed, but historically, the Precorp's billing process was built around four different cycles for doing meter reading, and the reason for that was, we couldn't read all the meters at one time. And so the four cycle meter reading had different usage periods during that particular cycle. And some of those usage periods would actually span different months. There's four cycles, and I think Joanne could get into a little more detail on the exact timing of those dates. But there are some cycles that bill exactly, month, they would bill the usage for that month in that month. There are some cycles that were outside of the month by varying weeks.
Does Precorp have any plans on fixing the implementation dates of new rates?
Yeah, as I mentioned, that was our historical practice. This past year, because of all the way that meter reading cycle worked, it also had, and Joanne could explain the gory details on this, but it had impacts on our ability to produce to produce and close our monthly financials. And so we find ourselves, a couple months past the end of the last month, and I was wanting to know, what's the financials look like, and we couldn't tell. And this had been something that, up until Joanne coming on board, wasn't something. I asked the question several times from our group, and nobody really had the level of experience that Joanne had in process, this type of processes. And Joanne, working with her team, was able to come up with a process that not only impacted the billing department, but also had significant impact on the operations, the meter reading, and the verifications that go on. but they were able to re-engineer the process and transition ourselves to where everything that all our usage is always is now all billed in that same month. And so that's helped us get our financial statements done sooner and has just made things much more, I think, a lot more tighter operationally. And that was, I believe that was effective in November 2016, subject to check from Joanne.
Does Precorp have members that do not get billed on a monthly cycle?
Yes, we have a class of members. We call it seasonal accounts, but the seasonal is a little bit of a the definition of that, you might think that's just like a cabin that comes once a year. But we actually have stock wells that are our primary seasonal accounts are small service wells, just a water well that are out in various pastures. And over the history of the co-op, those have been designated to be billed once a year in October. Typically, I think that's because of people sell cows, and so there's an influx of cash that comes in about the time that those bills would be due.
And what would the effect to those ratepayers be if there was a rate increase or decrease in the middle of that billing period?
Well, I think, I'm not saying this is correct from potentially the staff's perspective, but typically when we implemented rates on an effective date, when we rendered bills at that date, then all the usage would get billed. So for instance, the stock wells, their billing goes through the whole year. Whatever rate we had approved and effective on the date that they were billed, that's what we were going to bill them for their usage.
Is the cooperative going to look into being able to prorate bills?
That would be a question that would be more suitable for Joanne. I think we're always willing to look at things. I think the technical aspects of that, she would be much more qualified to answer.
I'd like to switch topics to Black Hills Electric. Can you please explain the relationship Precorp has with Black Hills Electric?
There are Black Hills and Precorp have, we have sort of an agreement where there's some places that we can serve from, like we can serve that our power is closer to their customers than their system. And there are places in Wyoming where the South Dakota system is closer to the Wyoming customers. And so rather than each of our co-ops go through the expense of building line to get to customers that they're closer to, we have agreements with Black Hills where they would sell us a small amount of power to serve our customers. We tap into their South Dakota line and serve our customers in Wyoming, and then we would have a delivery in Wyoming that they would take into South Dakota to deliver power to their customers, and that that gets billed on our average wholesale rate.
So from the explanation you just provided, it sounds like Black Hills Electric is not a member of Precorp.
No.
Are you aware of a staff issue that there is a double recovery?
Yes, I'm aware of that. And I know staff has been working on resolving that.
Thank you. I have no more questions.
Thank you, Ms. Fish. Mr. Walker, do you have any questions?
I have no questions. Thank you.
Ms. Kosky.
No questions.
Commissioner Bray, you're a witness.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a few topics here, not really scripted questions, so we'll just kind of see how this goes.
Okay.
My first topic is jurisdiction and our authority. As you probably gathered from my exchange with your counsel last week, I have some concerns about the company's position about what our authority is in this proceeding. Because I'd like to hear that from you. Including, are there any limits? What is our authority under our rules, and how does that jive with our obligation to protect your customers, your members?
That question doesn't come as a surprise to me, but I'm still trying to figure out the best answer.
I won't get upset as I did last week.
Yeah, okay, good.
I'll try not to. I've never responded very well when people tell me what I couldn't do.
She's taking down the computer so she can get at you fast. I'm
good. Well, obviously, that's when you take a look at it. I mean, that is really a very crucial question because it has implications that are sort of policy implications and legal implications and common sense implications, all these things tied into it. I'm going to take a pass on arguing the merits of federal preemption because I think that's really better for the lawyers. But I do know from a commission perspective, there are things that a commission looks at, can look at, and the things that a commission doesn't look at or can't look at. And there are lots of examples of that around us. So I would hope that if from Precorp's perspective, when we say that we think our wholesale power bill from Basin represents Precorp's commodity costs, we entered a contract that we entered in good faith with all the knowledge of what was going on at Basin. We presented that contract when we developed our COPA mechanism, and we represented the results of that contract to be our commodity costs. And we would certainly like the commission to continue with the previous decisions that those are commodity costs from Precorp's perspective. We would certainly like that outcome. To the extent that when we take a look at the COPA mechanism, clearly how we go about collecting the COPA, how we go about collecting those costs, whether first of all, as I've realized, I'd like to think that my team and I and everything that we do is perfect. And I don't like it when we find mistakes, but we find some. And this case is clear, has some of those little things that have been mistakes that have been included or found or discovered within the COPA mechanism. So we certainly look for the commission's input on how we go about collecting and the philosophy of how we do that in the COPA. We collect, we're billed from our wholesale commodity costs from Basin. They're a component of a fixed charge. There's a component of a demand charge. There's a component of an energy charge. We take those costs and we recover them through energy. And I think there's a real discussion from the commission's perspective on is that the proper way to recover those costs, because it does, it's expeditious to do it that way. But I think at any time you look at it, if you're billing something that's a cost that's based on demand and energy and you're recovering on energy, you have to make a judgment on that. Is that fair? And I think that has been a finding that the commission has found that our mechanism is fair. So clearly the mechanism, the calculations, how we go about recovering that is clearly within the commission's purview.
So a mathematical review.
Well, I think there's mathematics and philosophy too, whether it's within the public interest to recover those power costs that are driven by demand and energy based on energy. I think that's not a mathematics, that's a policy decision.
So we can move things around within the rate schedule
I'm trying to get to my easy sides first and then get to the tougher stuff in the middle.
Okay.
But if that's okay.
Sure.
Yeah. And so we've approached the commission that our Basin wholesale power contract, as represented by the Class A rate, is Precorp's wholesale power costs. And how we've approached that in our COPA mechanism, that those were pass-through costs. Our desire in our thinking, especially when we take and look some of the legal questions that we have, I think that's an area that we're all going to struggle with on what is the commission's role. And it doesn't mean that we don't like the commission and we don't value the relationship that we have with the commission, because I think that couldn't be further from the truth. But if you, in my mind, and I'm not a lawyer and I'm not trying to make a legal argument, but in my mind, if we don't preserve that, then what happens is things start to get picked out of those commodity costs. Then we are then for some reason, either forcing Precorp to break its contract with Basin or forcing Precorp to go to Basin and somehow get a rate change, which becomes a regulatory action at the Basin level, and all that gets very complicated. So, you know, our position and what we've asked for in this COPA mechanism is that we do like we've done historically, but we look at the Basin as commodity costs, and the commission can clearly approve how we collect those, making sure that our math is correct, making sure that it meets the public interest and how we spread those costs, our true up periods, those sorts of things. And I think the wholesale power costs, unlike when an investor-owned utility goes into the market and buys wholesale power in the market, and a customer doesn't like that contract that they purchased the power for, the commission, I don't believe the commission goes in and looks at that contract and what drove that particular contract, but they would look at, was the management, prudent, I guess. It seems like a legal word, I'm afraid to use that, but was the management making good management decisions in going to the market in the first place? And it seems like the commission's purview for me, the way I look at it, is definitely questioning, was that a good decision on management to do that? But going in and unpacking a contract that somebody's entered in, I'm not sure of the role of the commission in that.
I'm glad you mentioned IOUs. We'll probably get back to that in a second, because that's one of the things I'm struggling with. We have a similar mechanism for Rocky Mountain Power, net power cost adjustment. And I'm thinking about that. That's in the back of my mind as I'm trying to process this COPA. And there are some things that I'm struggling with on how to compare those two. So we'll get back to that in a minute. But staying with jurisdiction for a minute, I've sensed some annoyance in the pleadings filed that the interveners intervened, some whatever about our role in this. I guess I'm not understanding what it is that the cooperative thinks this proceeding should look like.
Well, I certainly like the proceedings where we approve the COPA in 15 minutes. I like that a lot. To the extent that questions have been raised, I mean, we've, setting the legal argument on jurisdiction aside, and that's something I really can't answer. But when we, as we developed, as we filed the case and as this case has developed, it's certainly much different than it is now than when we initially filed it, as far as what we've learned about concerns. But the motion that we made for summary judgment, highlighting the federal preemption, we didn't do that way before we actually did our case. We responded to this, we responded to all the discovery, we did the work to present all the stuff that we needed, and we also made that argument in addition to. It seems like if we were thumbing our nose at the commission's role and authority in this, that what we would have done was made our motion, early on to see if we could have stopped having to go through all the stuff that we've gone through. And then if we were successful, then, go from there. But we presented the cases and all the information, and we engaged the witnesses from Basin Electric to come in and support the story about the relatedness of DGC to Basin operations, even though that federal preemption question is still out there. And so I hope that you would take that as a sign that we do respect the commission's role. We do understand, your desire to protect ratepayers, all ratepayers in Wyoming, and we take your role seriously in doing that.
So, looking at Commission Exhibit 125. And I want to make sure I'm not getting on confidential information here. This appears to me not to be confidential, yet the one that's at issue here, Precorp Exhibit 7, is confidential. Is that correct? Precorp Exhibit 7, which I think is the previous schedule.
confidential, but this one is not?
That is correct. Precursor Exhibit 7 is confidential, this one is. I better check this. I believe that's accurate, Commissioner Brown.
Thank you. So, not to belabor this, but I just want to understand, when something like Exhibit 7 is filed with the commission, we shouldn't bother ourselves about why those numbers are different than the rate schedule that we have on file. The fact that you've decided not to challenge it, the Basin Board has approved it, should be sufficient for us to not wonder about any of the causes of those increases.
I think it would be hard for the commission not to wonder and want information, but I think what we try to do is present that. But I think to the extent that you get to the point where the commission wants to change those, wants Basin to change them, or wants to create a situation where Precorp has to go and either make Basin change it or, you know, not pay our power bill or something like that, I think that's the issue. But being able to understand and see how the rates are developed and ask questions about that, I think that's fair.
But what's the point of that?
Well, I think knowledge is good.
And but we can't do anything about it.
That remains to be seen.
From your position, position, there's nothing we can do about that.
From our position, the federal preemption argument, the Basin commodity cost is much like the commission reaching into, you know, a contract, an investor-owned utility on the market. It's the contract and what goes into it, what makes that contract, is not something I think the commission has jurisdiction on, but the fact is, did management make good decisions in entering those contracts?
Do you have any sympathy for the intervener's argument that you are forcing them to become equity partners in a business that they didn't choose to?
Well, I'm not sure that they have equity partners in, equity partners is, that's sort of a, begins to be a very complicated question.
Okay, because, let me try another way.
Yeah.
Do you have any sympathy that through this rate increase, you're telling your members that they have to infuse cash into a non-regulated entity that they did not choose to invest in?
Well, I wouldn't look at it that way.
Okay.
The basin rate increase was driven by the Basin consolidated financial, the end of the year, the projected financials not meeting appropriate financial targets. If those targets were not met and Basin lost its credit rating and we had to borrow, and Basin, you know, as you know, utilities are capital intensive, and Basin was borrowing money at a higher interest rate, then they would be subject to those costs. And so the decision that the Basin Board made and that the members supported in this mid-year rate increase wasn't about making them equity investors in DGC. And I don't have the accounting background. Hopefully I have witnesses that can talk about that. But this was supporting Basin's consolidated financials.
Okay. One of the five reasons that Basin listed, and we can go through, we can cite however many different places you want to see this. Basin didn't just do this once. They did on several documents, listed DGC's losses as a reason for the rate increase. Do we agree on that?
That's in the language.
And because of that, DGC was going to require a cash infusion from Basin to keep them operational.
For answering that to the witnesses from Basin.
So as a board member approving this rate increase with Basin, you didn't understand that that's what you were doing, is getting a cash infusion to DGC?
Well, I'm not a member of the Basin Board, so I wasn't part of the decision. I was part of the group of the member managers that represent the, you know, the various members of Basin, but understood that if the Basin consolidated financial didn't meet certain metrics, that would affect Basin's credit rating, which would impact all the customers.
I just don't think you're answering my question. Maybe
I'm sorry.
You just don't want to, which is fine. I'm just trying to understand if you see a difference for your members in paying an increased rate to support utility-related functions versus paying an increased rate to support a non-regulated entity.
I think DGC is non-regulated, but it is related to Basin. DGC is the fuel supply side of DGC.
So the answer is no. No difference.
No difference.
While we have Exhibit 7 and Exhibit 125 out, and without going into any confidential issues, I don't want to talk about any numbers. In your experience with Precor over the last 16, 17 years, if my math is correct, you've looked at a lot of these changes from year to year. When you look at the rate sheet, that's page 1 of Exhibit 125, and compare that to Exhibit 7, in your experience, can you just give me some sense of the magnitude of that rate change? Is that something that is fairly customary? Were you surprised by how big it was? Just some indication of your initial reaction to the changes in those numbers.
Yeah. Well, I mean, some rule of thumb stuff that I have learned over the years is it's a 20 million-ish represents about a mil, maybe a little more than that on Basin rate. As far as, you know, that kind of those increased dollars impacts the rate by a mil. Of course, the rate is demand and energy, and that, you know, depending on the system load factor, it could be different. But we have typically seen Basin rate increases. Well, when we were growing, I mean, there was either no increases or even, you know, some lessening of rate because of bill credits and other things. But typically, like a 3 mil increase was something that, you know, we would have, you know, kind of used to seeing those in the forecasts. So this was a 7 mil on average. If you take a look at it just on the average over the course of the year, the 7 mil increase, that was a pretty significant increase compared to historical rates.
Thank you. I believe this morning, Mr. Burbridge distributed a copy of the 2001 order that established the COPA. Do you have that in front of you? I don't know that we made that an exhibit.
We did not.
And it's not necessary to, obviously. It's different.
And just for the record, I've discussed that with parties, and they agree that it wasn't necessary to make it an exhibit, that we're certainly at liberty and the authority to refer to our own orders. And to use them in our draft order.
Thank you. This is a rare opportunity to have two witnesses that were there at the time here with us today. So I'm going to take advantage of that opportunity. As you can see from the front of it, none of the commissioners that issued this order are sitting at the bench today. So as a commissioner trying to make this decision, I went back and looked at this to try to get some understanding of what the parameters of this COPA were when the commission set it up. I'd like to look at paragraph 18 on page 4. I think the subject matter in paragraph 18 and 19 is the same. Paragraph 18 is your interpretation. Paragraph 19 is Hedrick's interpretation. Could you help me with what type of bill credit we're talking about there? What caused the bill credit? Why you argue that it should not be part of the COPA mechanism?
Yes, I can. As I recall, and I believe at this time, the power markets were extremely high. If I'm not mistaken, Basin was making significant system off sales or off system sales to non-members, and certainly I would if I'm in any way incorrect in this, I'm sure, hopefully I'm not conflicting with Mark Foss's recollection, if you want to follow up with him on questions on that. But so there was significant cost, there were significant sales that Basin was making off system, and that generated just a bunch of revenue. And so, you know, Basin could have. I think they look at the quickest way to get the money back to the members is what they were trying to do. And so we had that, we had a bill credit, and it wasn't any sort of a, you know, it wasn't a reduction in any of our rates to Basin. Our rates are still the same. Just we showed up with that bill had a, you know, a credit on it. And that, you know, that the bill crediting over Basin, you know, again, because we are member owned and member controlled, whenever the members are able to look at the rates and look at the revenues, it either comes from the board or comes from the membership, depends. But that bill credit was a way to get money back to the members as quickly as possible. And, otherwise, if Basin would have not bill credited that, then it would have shown up as margin, you know, that year. And then that would have become a year when Basin was retiring capital credits. That would have been a year that would have taken many years to probably pay down. So they retired those bill credits, or but gave us a bill credit. I think I've had a history of confusing capital credits and bill credits in front of the commission. They took the bill credit, passed it on to the members. Then we approached the commission with the bill credit and said, you know, this is not part of our rate. It wasn't generated by our rates. And we decided, rather than flow it through the COPA mechanism, that we would in turn do a bill credit to our members.
If the off-market sales that you're talking, off-system sales that you're talking about, did not produce a benefit, but instead were a cost, would those be run through the COPA?
Yes, I think they would have.
So one thing that I'm looking at through all this, and my next set of questions will probably go to this, is just trying to get some consistency between the way we're treating different items within the COPA. And so that is helpful to me in terms of that discussion. I'd like to look at Exhibit 2.2. Bates, page 68. Yes. So one way that I'm thinking about these costs and these benefits are that there are embedded costs and embedded benefits within the COPA related to DGC. I think Basin testimony, rebuttal testimony was very helpful in that regard in trying to indicate what those embedded benefits are in terms of coal contracts.
$90 million, roughly.
It appears to me, though, that there's another bucket of either benefits or costs related to DGC. And I'm looking for consistency in how we treat those. So, page 68 appears to me to show the four times that DGC revenues have resulted in a bill credit to Basin members. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And tell me how those benefits were treated. Did they come through the COPA to lower the COPA rates, or were they given to members as a bill credit?
They were provided as bill credits. But there was some, I think, in some years, I believe we retained portion of the bill credit for risk management on coal bed methane. And then last year, there was a bill credit, not last year, there was a bill credit that we received that we completely retained ourselves and didn't give it back and flow that to the bottom line. So, but these were bill credits. They weren't changes in the Basin rate. They were credits on our bill, and they at this time, the commodity markets were very robust. And in addition to the $90 million that was sort of embedded in Basin's cost of service, embedded benefits in Basin's cost of service, these revenues were coming in. And there was a policy that was made at the Basin Board to return these credits, return these as bill credits to the membership.
I may not find it, but my recollection of reviewing all the materials was that those profits from DGC went to Precor's bottom line.
There was not all years. It's been a mix over the years of bill credits. I think all the DGC bill credits were either returned directly to the customers. Bill credits that were derived from DGC profits were either returned to the customers or held for that customer for the risk management.
I should have thought of a better term than other bucket revenues and expenses, but if this is other bucket revenue that was handled the way that it was handled, and I look at this DGC piece in this COPA as another bucket cost, why would that come through the COPA when these were not taken through the COPA?
Yeah. The reason, as I mentioned, the DGC impacts resulted in the basin, DGC had projected losses. That was impacting the basin consolidated financials. The only way that Basin could prevent, I guess, from the financials from failing metrics was to increase the Basin rate. The Basin rate was increased, therefore that provided the margin to meet the financial requirements for the Basin consolidated financials. So by virtue of how that, and that translates into the Basin cost of service and ends up flowing through ratably to Precor through the demand and energy costs.
One of the things I'm struggling with is how we do this mechanism with IOUs. Rocky Mountain Power's net power cost adjustment, for example, is very specific about what category of costs can be included. And then within those categories, we have plenty of arguments about whether it's prudent or could have been done better or differently. It seems to me we don't have a lot of parameters here and consistency in how we're treating things that flow through the COPA. And our order setting that up doesn't provide that sort of parameter. But we're protective of a power cost adjustment mechanism because it's done outside of a general rate case. And we want to be, I want to be very specific about those issues that we allow to change rates outside of a rate case. And it's a rare mechanism that we allow utilities to have to try to deal with volatility to prevent rate cases. But it, in my mind, is something that has to be very protected and very specific about the parameters of that so that it doesn't just become a mini rate case without the scrutiny of the rate case.
Could I respond to that?
Absolutely.
One of the things, as you are comparing COPAs and looking at the challenges, between the investor model and the co-op model, one of the things that you have that's different than the co-op model, besides the things I've already talked about, is that if you collect money, you collect rates, and those rates are more than you thought, then the members get the benefit of that through the capital credit process, which isn't a mechanism that happens within the investor and utility. So you are, when there is extra money there, you have customers and you have shareholders. So, you might say that a natural conflict, maybe the right term. In the co-op, those stakeholders are the customers and the owners are the same. And so there are other mechanisms in the co-op world that if things, like bill credits or like other things, capital credit retirements, that over time, all those dollars that may have been more than what you thought you were going to get, they do eventually go back to the members.
And I understand that. referring back to Exhibit 2.2 in the IOU model, for example, those profits would have gone to shareholders. But similarly, if this request for cash infusion to a non-regulated entity had come to the commission, we would have likely said, that's for shareholders. So in trying to be consistent about how we look at those things, and I understand those are very different models, I guess my ultimate question is, in the REA model, the cooperative model, that amount may be recoverable, but is it properly recoverable in the COPA? Or should it be recovered in general rates or in another mechanism because of the way we've treated it in the past, because it is a different sort of cost? It's not necessarily a cost of power.
Well, I guess from this is where we might differ a little, because of our wholesale contract with Basin, when that shows up on our as a rate, a Class A rate, then that is something that we consider. From our perspective, that defines our commodity cost. The bill credit is outside of the rates. And, you know, we did, this isn't defensive. I'm not trying to be defensive here, but we did advise the commission that the bill credits were coming, and we advised them that the commission of how we intended to handle those. I would guess in the future, if there are bill credits, they'll probably get much more scrutiny and maybe a different discussion than we have in the past. But we presented that, and we tried to keep the commission informed.
And I'm not criticizing at all the way that those were handled. All I'm saying is if those were handled this way, and now we have something on the other side that's not embedded, shouldn't we treat it the same way?
And I think the difference the difference is where these were coming in, and this was giving money back to the members through the form of a bill credit versus the impacts that we've seen to bolster the basin financials were reflected in rates. And that's the difference between the two, in my mind.
I would like your reaction to my thought that this DGC piece, whatever it is not appropriately, may not be appropriately recovered in COPA, but may be recovered somewhere else. The fact that, because I think at this point you've been thinking it's all or nothing. We're either not going to get it or we're going to get all of it. What is your reaction to thinking that this may be recoverable in a different form, with different mechanism, with true rates?
Well, that certainly makes it, I guess at the end of the day, we would certainly want to be able to collect our power costs. We do think that it's important that it's recoverable through rates, because within the rates right now, whether or not Precorp has independently done an audit, we trust the analysis that Basin has done, and we've looked at these numbers you know, DGC has been the topic of discussion, you know, in good years and in bad years. And the fact is that embedded within our rates, embedded within the cost of service, is $90 million in benefit of DGC.
I'm not arguing with you about that.
And
really would like you to focus on this extra piece.
But if we are going to pull out the extra piece,
just like you have before,
that was not delivered to us through rates. I think that, again, that's my difference. One is a bill credit. One was done ratably under the Class A rate schedule. But if we were to consider disallowing this, whatever we were to determine through whatever the commission were to determine through the process, a disallowed amount of DGC, what's the other side of that question about the benefits that are currently in the rate?
They're embedded. I can see two different categories of costs and two categories of benefits. I'm just asking you to give me any response you have to my alternative recovery method.
We would much prefer that, obviously, we'd prefer that the bill credits remain, they are not part of our rate, our Class A rate. We would like to continue, if we get bill credits, to advise the commission of what, why, and how on the bill credits, as we've done historically. And these costs that we are discussing is related to the mid-year rate increase. We would like those to be included and considered part of our commodity cost.
Thank you. That's all I have.
Thank you, Commissioner Brighton. Deputy Chairman Russell, do you have questions?
Thank you, I do. Morning, Mr. Easley.
Good morning, Mr. Russell.
You mentioned, if I recall correctly in your testimony, that this is the first time that you're aware of that the Dakota gasification plant has become an issue in a COPA hearing.
Yes.
Do you know if it was ever explicitly blessed or approved by the commission in the past?
If I could answer that as a qualified answer, because if there's an order that that'll stand on its own, but I don't believe there has been a very explicit commission order. I think the commission, as I recall from just recalling the orders, I think the last one I recall, I can't tell you which year this was, but there was language that said that this issue would be more properly discussed in a rate case if somebody wanted to bring it up. I think that's some language that's in one of the orders, but I can't tell you where it is, but we could find it.
Okay, and speaking about Dakota itself?
No, I think it was more about bill credits. Bill credits and how they were being handled.
Yeah, see, what I'm trying to get to is that I've been around a little over 4 years and I've never heard of the plant before, and I'm wondering if it wasn't challenged or talked about before is because nobody knew about it. I'm not blaming anyone for it, but
I think everybody knew about it, it's just that it was delivering. Not only was it delivering, not only has DGC been delivering the, you know, what we call them synergistic benefits, the $90 million that I think Sue has identified, it's been delivering those benefits embedded in the cost of service. And then as the bill credits came from DGC, we were very, very open with DGC, you know, the gasification company delivering these benefits. I don't think we ever had discussions on DGC impacting Basin anything other than positive. And still from the perspective of the embedded benefits from DGC, it's still positive.
And did I hear you correctly during your testimony that mentioned that some of the gas produced by Dakota is used by Basin in its power plants?
Well, I think I almost said that and I caught myself. I said Basin uses natural gas in its generators, and it also produces natural gas at DGC. I mean, just like a utility, if a utility does displacement deals where they have X generation in one area and utility A has excess generation, utility B needs it. In this other area, utility A, you know, has it and has excess and doesn't need it, and somebody does, they exchange. Basin puts gas into the pipeline and it takes gas out of the interstate system. I can't tell you, I don't know if those are the same molecules. But to the extent that Basin is producing gas and using gas, DGC becomes sort of an effective hedge against gas prices. Also, because transportation is also a cost in gas, there's probably more economical transactions for Basin than to wheel gas from, you know, it's going into the pipeline to a particular generator. So I think the ubiquitous nature of the gas system, Basin's putting gas into the, you know, putting gas in and then taking gas out. I don't know that there's a direct usage of DGC gas. I know that there is a pipeline between DGC and ABS for startup. So I would say in that sort of the case, definitely Basin is using the gas, but I think Mark or Sue could answer that question specifically much better than I, but they're related. Just like DGC is related to coal, DGC uses coal because of the way the gasifier works. It can't use coal that is very fine, and so the fines that it can't use, it sends those to ABS. ABS burns those at a discount, at a benefit to the membership. So the Basin, to me, the related nature of DGC you know, from a functional operational perspective, really is around fuel. It produces gas, and it doesn't produce coal, but it certainly produces fines, or a result of their process is fines that go to ABS, and it also drives economies of scale for a basin's plant. Without the ABS volumes, the production cost of that coal would be much higher.
I want to talk a little bit about the benefits versus costs of the GC relationship. Now you've testified, and you also referenced Ms. Sorensen's testimony to show how even in what appears to be one of the worst financial years for DGC, if not the worst in recent history anyway, that there's still a net benefit to a basin that flows down to the Precourt. And in Ms. Sorensen's testimony, she pointed out with a fair amount of detail how much of the benefit flows from different areas, how much flows from coal, how much flows from power supply, shared administrative costs, shared facilities, et cetera. Are you familiar with that testimony?
I am.
Subsequent to that, interveners sent out a discovery request for support information and backup information on where those numbers come from and to show that that's really happening. And the answer that came back from Precorp was, that's too hard. It's too much. It's too difficult. It's burdensome. We can't do it. Now, if you're a trust but verify guy like I am, how does that help me?
I don't see that that does.
Is it possible that during the course of this hearing in the next day or so, that maybe we'll hear a little bit more about that?
I think if there's any questions on DGC that you have, I'm very confident that Sue and Sue Sorensen and Mr. Foss can address those.
Okay. Now, that being said, let's stay on the trust part for a second. And let's say that everything that has been said is true, and that there is, I believe, it came out to a net benefit of approximately $23 million. And some portion of that would flow back to Precorp, probably somewhere around 18 or 20%, something like that.
Precorp is about 10% of, or a little under 10% of basin now. At one time, we were much more on a percentage basis.
And that is in what everybody seems to agree is a poor financial year for Dakota. So let's say that you had the power to snap your fingers and starting today or starting back on January 1st of this year, that Dakota gasification plant was no longer a part of the formula for wholesale power costs between basin and Precorp. Just take it out of the picture, and that means no more benefits, no more costs. If that happened, wouldn't one thing be that the cost to Precorp for energy from basin would go up?
I believe it would.
But at the same time, if that happened, it would make the interveners in this case very happy because they would wish to remove themselves from Dakota.
I think the interveners, as I understand their case, they are wanting to, their argument is to eliminate what they've calculated as the DGC costs, but to let the DGC benefits remain embedded in the rate.
Why don't we go ahead and take a break right now, and we will reconvene at 11:30.